This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoen. On November 4th, 1995, Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin was murdered by an Israeli religious zealot named Yigal Amir. He had been stalking Rabin for 2 years, ever since Rabin had shaken hands with PLO leader Yasser Arafat on the White House lawn and had signed the Oslo Accords. Amir was a law student and believed the Torah gave him justification to kill the prime minister. Our guest Dan Efron covered the assassination and the trial of Amir when he was posted in Israel as a reporter. His new book about the events leading up to the murder and its aftermath is titled Killing a King, The Assassination of Yitzhak Rabin and the Remaking of Israel. While there's no way to know if there would have been a two-state solution had Rabin lived, there has been little or no progress on the peace talks in the last 20 years. Dan Efron joins us on Radio Times to talk about this pivotal time in Israeli history. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Congratulations on the book as well.
Thank you, Marty.
You know, we've had our share of political assassinations in this country. I'm curious about the impact in Israel 20 years ago. And I ask that because, of course, it's a tiny country compared to the United States. And at one point, in this story, Yigal Amir and Yitzhak Rabin are at a wedding together. They do not know each other, but just showing the closeness of the people living in this small country.
Right. Israel is a very informal country, and I think that expressed itself, among other ways, at the time in terms of the kind of protection that Rabin had or didn't have. There were four or five bodyguards that would trail Rabin in that period leading up to the assassination. Even in the period where Israel is very polarized, this peace deal, the Oslo peace process, has a lot of detractors, a lot of opponents, and there are death threats against Rabin, and yet the security remained the same, more or less, four or five bodyguards. The wedding is this moment. It actually comes a couple of years before the assassination.
Exactly.
But it's that first moment where Amir sees Rabin in the flesh. He's invited to a wedding. It's the wedding of the daughter of the chief rabbi. The groom is a former classmate of Amir, of the would-be assassin. And Rabin is there. He's invited. He's the prime minister. And Amir watches him come in with just a couple of bodyguards, sees him across the room. He's got his gun on him because Amir carries this 9mm Beretta everywhere he goes. And he thinks, I have an opportunity here, and I could end the peace process right now by going over there and killing him. But he hesitates, and Rabin leaves, and Amir tells himself, I might come to regret this if I don't have another opportunity.
Well, you mentioned the security, and Rabin, he resented the security. He didn't want to wear a bulletproof vest. He didn't want to have security details so closely around him. He didn't even like the car he was given. It was a Cadillac, a car that he was given to be driven around in.
That's right. And his security people, the people around him, the Secret Service people, the intelligence agencies are all telling him in the months leading up to this event, we have to protect you better. And that involves a bulletproof vest, which he refuses. He does agree to have this armored car imported to Israel, this Cadillac. It's the kind of car that President Clinton is being driven around in at the time here in the United States. But he hates the car. He hates the Cadillac. It's heavy and lumbering. And he had been used to being driven around, and I think it was a Chevy Caprice, which was fast, and he liked it a lot. He was a problem for the Secret Service in trying to improve the protection around him.
And I do want to talk about Yigal Amir, but just a little bit on Rabin. He was a general, a hawk, certainly involved in the 1967 war. Why was he interested in – I know he – even looking at the pictures, you can tell the handshake on the White House lawn, not the friendliest of handshakes. But what did he want out of this agreement? And why did he see this in Israel's interest?
Right. So Rabin is a centrist, and he's a military general who turns to politics. But he is on the hawkish side of the Labor Party, of this left-center Labor Party. And he is the defense minister during the first Palestinian uprising in the late 80s. This is that uprising where Palestinians are taking to the streets in large numbers. They're protesting. They're throwing stones and petrol bombs. This is not the era of the suicide bombings that comes later. So Rabin's response is very aggressive. He orders an aggressive crackdown against the first Palestinian uprising. But it shifts something in his own thinking. I think he talks about this later in speeches. He writes about this. He comes to terms with the idea that Palestinians will not settle for Israel's military rule over them, over millions of Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza, in that condition where Palestinians don't have the kinds of rights that Israeli citizens do, and that in order to maintain that occupation, that military rule, Israel would have to live by the sword forever. He also talks about this idea, and again, he comes to this during the course of that Intifada, that first Palestinian uprising, that Israel's military rule over the Palestinians is toxic for Israeli society. He doesn't talk so much about the humanitarian aspects for Palestinians, but what it does to Israelis and to Israeli society.
I do want to play a clip from that event on the White House lawn. But, I mean, clearly, as you write and as he said, he saw it as Israel's security, that having some – it's not even clear he got to a two-state solution, but certainly he saw it in Israel's best interest – to be able to come to some deal with the Palestinians.
Exactly. Some accommodation with the Palestinians that would give Israel a respite from those decades of war and really take Israel out of that cycle of violence.
Well, let's play a clip. This is just about 40 seconds, and this is from the signing of the Oslo Peace Accord, September 1993.
Indeed, I would like to thank all those who have made this day possible. What we are doing today is more than signing an agreement. It is a revolution. Yesterday, a dream. Today, a commitment. The Israeli and the Palestinian peoples who fought each other for almost a century have agreed to move decisively on the path of dialogue, understanding, and cooperation.
You know, it's kind of heartbreaking to listen to that, knowing, of course, what hasn't happened in the last 20 years.
Yeah, I should say that's actually the Israeli foreign minister at the time. That's Shimon Peres.
Our mistake.
Who spoke from the stage, and so did Rabin. Rabin talked about that idea of swords into plowshares. And it was this historical moment. It was very clear. The idea that Israelis that the Israeli prime minister would stand on the stage outside the White House and shake hands with Yasser Arafat, this man that for Israelis really embodied terrorism. I think even a month before this ceremony, no one would have conceived in Israel. No one would have conceived of this idea.
Well, even rolling back the clock 20 years, I mean, I think there was a great sense of hope and optimism around the world. But as you write in this book, it seemed that that peace agreement really divided Israel.
Yeah, Israel was a polarized society in the 90s and going into that period, and the peace process really sharpened that polarization right down the middle. You know, about 50% of Israelis supported it and felt it offered hope for Israel, hope for a better future. And then the other half thought that this was either a risk that was too great to bear, a risk for Israeli security, or they looked at it in terms of the religious issue, the idea of giving back land that was promised to the Jews in the Torah, in the Jewish Bible, that this was a betrayal of Judaism.
Well, that's certainly how Yigal Amir felt. This is the man who assassinated Yitzhak Rabin. You have interviewed his family. You've interviewed his brother.
That's right.
You've seen video of him, I guess, being interrogated after he was arrested. Why did he want to kill Yitzhak Rabin?
Amir tells himself, and really from the start, Amir watches that ceremony that we just heard. He sees that on television. He's at home in the bedroom that he grew up in with his brother, who eventually gets convicted as a co-conspirator. The two of them are watching, and they see this ceremony, and they tell themselves, this is against Judaism. It's against God. And they tell themselves right then and there that they would try to stop it, maybe through organizing rallies. And Amir does that. He organizes protests on campus. He's a law student and later in other places. But that if that doesn't work, he says, I'm going to catch up to him. I will stalk him. I will find him, and I will kill him if I need. He even sees this. He comes to see it as a suicide mission. He's willing to die in order to stop this process.
You write about something called Rodef. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
That's right.
Moser or M-O-S-E-R?
Moser.
Moser.
Yeah.
As two, I guess, what beliefs that seem to inspire Amir.
Yeah, these are Talmudic doctrines, Din Rodef and Din Moser, that appear in the Talmud, that talk about this idea that when someone jeopardizes Jews, when someone puts Jews in jeopardy, then the bystander has not only the right to kill him, but the religious obligation to kill him. And he, Amir and his brother Haggai, they're smart young men. They've studied. They're deeply religious. They know scripture very well. They've studied in religious schools and really some of the best schools in Israel, schools and seminaries. So they know these doctrines very well. And he makes the case to himself and to friends that a death sentence hangs over Rabin in terms of religious law.
So sort of turning to the Torah to justify assassination. But as you write in this book, it's really Yigal Amir who's commits, what is it, Rodef?
Right, because Amir is pursuing Rabin. And the whole idea of Rodef is this pursuit, the idea that someone is pursuing Jews with the intention of killing them, and then you have the right to kill him, to kill the pursuer. It's the law of the pursuer is the precise translation of the term. In effect, this is exactly what Amir himself was doing with Rabin.
You had talked about some of the protests, and this was, I guess, after the Oslo Accords. And some of these protests were first of all, they're very, very well populated, if I can put it that way. People dressing up in, dressing up Rabin in Nazi uniforms. I mean, clearly there was a very strong and outspoken group that were opposed to Yitzhak Rabin and what he was doing.
Right. And this is the period as the Oslo process moves forward. You know, it does two things. I think it generates a real sense of hope, but it also generates a backlash of violence on both sides. This is the period where the suicide bombings begin on the Palestinian side by the Islamic Hamas group. And that makes that Israeli opposition to Oslo even more extreme and more angry. And they come out to the streets in large numbers and they portray Rabin, who had been the head of the military. He had been the hero of the Six-Day War in 1967. They portray him as a murderer. They dress him up in a keffiyeh to make him look like Arafat, an Arab headdress, and also in a Nazi uniform, in an SS uniform.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Dan Efron. We're talking about something that happened 20 years ago, the assassination of Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. Dan Efron writes about this in his new book. It's called Killing a King, subtitled The Assassination of Yitzhak Rabin and the Remaking of Israel. Taking a very short break, we'll get back to our conversation. Much more to talk about. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Dan Efron. He served as the Jerusalem bureau chief for Newsweek and also the Daily Beast. And he's got a new book called Killing a King about the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin. Happened just about 20 years ago. I'd love to have you just sort of walk through what happened. So this Yigal Amir basically had been stalking or certainly following Rabin as he moved through the country and did his job. On the day of the assassination, there was a big peace rally taking place. And I think Rabin didn't expect the crowd to be as big as it was. You were actually there.
That's right. Yeah. So Amir is simply reading in the paper about where Rabin will appear, where he's going to make his public appearances and give speeches. And he goes to these places several times over the course of the 2 years leading up to the assassination and doesn't quite connect with Rabin. In November, 20 years ago, in 1995, Rabin decided to have a peace rally. And this was you know, about 2 years after the start of the Oslo process, where there was both, we talked about this, both hope and violence, and it wasn't exactly clear how strong his support was and how strong the support was for the peace process. So this rally was really a litmus test for, you know, Israeli feelings about Oslo, and a very large crowd turned out, 100,000 people. I lived a few blocks away from the main square. I was reporting in Israel, and walked to that square and saw this crowd. It was supposed to be a short story that I was going to write that just says some number of people have showed up and this is what it means. Amir comes to the square and he sees the parking lot where Rabin has parked that Cadillac. And he realizes that if the car is there, then that's where Rabin will end up. And he manages to get into the parking lot and wait there for about 40 minutes. Nobody approaches him. It's a parking lot that's supposed to be secured just for Secret Service people and policemen. But he manages to get in without being questioned at all.
And gets within about a foot or so of Rabin and kills him on the spot.
Right. Yeah. As Rabin comes down from the stage, he manages to circle behind him and get between the bodyguards. Yeah, within about a foot and to fire three shots at Rabin. Two bullets enter Rabin's back.
And as far as the security was concerned, were they looking for Arabs perhaps, Muslims perhaps, maybe settlers who had more extreme beliefs, including people that might have supported Baruch Goldstein, who had killed up, 24 Palestinians as they worshipped?
Right, 29 Palestinians.
29.
This is the key question. Why was there this colossal failure? It was a failure of the security people around him. It was also a failure of intelligence. And there had been information. There had been death threats and information about people on the right or the far right posing a threat to Rabin. And I think, you know, one explanation or one component is simply that Israelis could not internalize the idea that it might be a fellow Jew who poses a threat to Rabin, a fellow Israeli. You know, this idea, I think, that the threat was always going to be from Palestinians or from Arabs was very deeply rooted. And so even when they're reading these reports about death threats from the Israeli right, it doesn't quite sink in.
He was Yigal Amir arrested right away, and there were – in fact, you saw some of these videotapes of him being interrogated. And as you said, he felt justified from his readings of the Torah that he was allowed to assassinate the prime minister of Israel. Was he in any way repentant or regretful about what he had done?
Not at all. And that was one of the interesting things that comes through. I had a chance to watch about 10 or 12 hours of the interrogation tapes of Yigal Amir. And it was very telling because Yigal Amir goes to prison. He's tried and he goes to prison. He sort of disappears into the prison system. There's no – Israelis don't allow interviews with him in prison. So these tapes really – you know, you get a sense for him. He's a very smart young man. He's sitting across from his interrogators and engaging with them. And he's proud to confess. He's already confessing in the police car on the way to the station and talking about these religious ideas, these religious justifications for killing Rabin.
God inspired, right?
Right. Right. And the fact that he managed to defy the odds, to get into that parking lot, think about whatever all the things we think or we know about Israeli security agencies are very well regarded, well trained. Amir manages to get through the barrier, get through the lines and kill Rabin. And so this is evidence to him that God wanted him to do this and helped him do it.
Is there any, I mean, we talk about terrorism today and sort of sadly we're seeing it all over the world or certainly in certain parts of the world. Is understanding Yigal Amir, is that helpful in trying to understand the mind of a terrorist or the mind of someone who would assassinate someone inspired by their God or their beliefs in God?
I imagine that there is a thread that connects them. I think, you know, and I'm not an expert on other forms of terrorism. I focused, you know, on him and tried to kind of get into his head. But I think certainly the idea that you have deeply held beliefs, maybe deeply held religious beliefs. And those beliefs tell you that the person who is acting in some way is an infidel, is a traitor. And the idea that that motivates you, that drives you to kill him, is probably mm-hmm. common to terrorists or terrorist groups in other parts of the world, sure.
You also had a chance to talk with his family, Amir's family, including his parents. What was their initial reaction to what their son had done?
They are surprised, shocked, I would say even horrified initially. Politically, they're on the side of Israel that opposes Rabin, that opposes his peace deals. But I don't think it occurred to them that their son was such an extremist that he might do he might commit murder. He might assassinate the Israeli leader. Their views shift over the years. So it starts with this idea of being horrified. I think pretty soon they are kind of not quite justifying, but let's say rationalizing it. They talk about the idea that Rabin was leading Israel to this terrible place, and Amir, his intentions were correct, at least in terms of wanting to spare Israel of this horrible fate. His mother, who is kind of the key figure in the family, eventually comes to this other position where she embraces these conspiracy theories that suggest that maybe her son didn't commit the act at all. And it's a weird disconnect because he, of course, is still very proud of it. He's never recanted. He's, you know, he stands by his confession. But his mother has doubts. We witnessed one of these moments where his mother's arguing with her other son, with Haggai, who is the co-conspirator. And she says, well, come on, tell the truth. You know that these conspiracies are probably true. And he says, Mom, we did it. You know, my brother took his gun. He went to the square. He killed Rabin.
And she won't believe it? I mean, somehow she has reframed what they're saying to what? I realize you're not a psychiatrist or anything like that, but sort of to justify her love for her son?
Something like that. I think she thinks that there are these larger forces, that they were young and naive, that certainly they had the ideological zeal. But there are these larger forces that were underway, and her son was used as a patsy.
And Haggai did, as a kind of, I guess, what, co-conspirator, but not the actual killer, did spend, what, 15, 16, 17 years in Israeli prison?
That's right, 16 and a half years in prison.
And you write in that prison, there are Palestinians in the prisons as well. What transpired for him in prison?
Well, so Haggai he's an interesting character. And I mentioned they're both smart. They're not, I think the impression I had 20 years ago covering the event was that these two guys, these two brothers were sort of marginal figures, not very smart. But engaging with the brother was quite surprising. And really, I guess some of the weirdest set of interviews I've done in my career, because you're sitting across someone who's done something horrific or taken part in something horrific, but he's interesting and articulate, and he's able to convey his views. He talked about a shift in prison. He doesn't regret the murder. This is the brother, Haggai.
Yeah.
But there was this subtle shift. He came to view, I think, Palestinians who were in prison alongside him as victims of the state as well, in the way that he perceives himself as a victim of the state. And so there were even these moments where they would seek his help.
Writing, right?
Exactly. Petitioning the court for certain rights that they had coming to them that maybe they couldn't petition for because their Hebrew wasn't very good, or they didn't know the law as well as he did. And so he would write out these petitions on their behalf. And this is really, sort of bewildering. Part of their ideology 20 years ago was that Arabs or Palestinians are sworn enemies of Israel, sworn enemies of Jews, and we have to kill Rabin so that he doesn't do anything that might possibly improve the lives of Palestinians.
And both these brothers had served in the military, so they clearly were comfortable with weapons. In fact, Haggai would make bullets, right? They were pretty involved in creating some of this weaponry.
Right. Both of them were in infantry units in the Israeli military. So, yeah, they learned to shoot. Haggai was a sniper in the military. His idea all along was, let's get a sniper gun and kill Rabin from a distance. His brother, Yigal Amir, the shooter, keeps saying, I don't trust our ability to do that. I want to get close. I want to see Rabin when I kill him. Haggai is also a tinkerer. He spends a lot of time in the shed in the backyard, making munitions, tampering with bullets, trying to make them to improve them so that they can penetrate a vest in case Rabin is wearing one.
And that's Dan Efron, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, talking about something that happened 20 years ago, November 4th, 1995. Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin murdered by an Israeli religious zealot, a man named Yigal Amir. Amir is in prison. His brother served some time in prison as well as an accomplice. And again, we're talking about the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin and also the remaking of Israel. That's part of the subtitle of this book, the effect that this assassination has had on that country since that time. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Did Yigal, did his brother Haggai, did they hate Palestinians?
I would say they did. I think they saw Palestinians as enemies of Israel, and they saw the conflict as irreconcilable. I don't know that they had personal interactions with Palestinians. Often Israelis don't, but they certainly viewed Palestinians as enemies. And enemies, not just of Israel, but of some greater concept of Judaism or of the right of Jews to inhabit all of the land that God promised to the Jews in the Bible.
I mean, is this all really about, not all, but is this about land when you sort of boil it down to its essentials?
That certainly is the crux. You know, it's hard to think, hostility has gone on for so long and is so deep. It's hard to imagine that this is primarily about real estate. But that is the conflict.
Yeah.
That is what the two sides are fighting over.
So can we say that Yigal Amir essentially won? I mean, he wanted to stop the peace process. It would have given Palestinians more authority over their lives, more land as well eventually. Can we say that he was successful?
I think he certainly would say that. He certainly views it that way. So does his brother, Haggai. I think they think that they intervened in this process at a key moment. And I think that's largely correct. If you look at Rabin, he was this unique figure because of his record in war, his military background. Part of the thing that these peace processes raise, the concern for Israelis, is that giving back land exposes Israel to danger. Rabin was the general who captured the West Bank and Gaza in that Six-Day War. So when he said Israel can afford to take these security risks and give back this territory, it was very hard to argue with him on a security level.
I mean, has anyone been able to sort of fill those shoes with that kind of resume?
Well, no, I guess
in the last 20 years. Yeah.
Right. So the short answer is no. And then I would just add, and this is, part of the nuance to the key question. There were trends underway in Israel that go back before 1995. The murder was the pivotal moment. But there were these kind of trends that pointed to a shift from pragmatists like Rabin to ideologues like the current prime minister, like Netanyahu and others. When we talked about Israel being a polarized society, about 50-50 in the 90s, it's not so much like that anymore. It's a more distinctly right-wing country. Yeah, right-wing populace.
You're right, and I hadn't thought of it quite this way, is that Benjamin Netanyahu has been prime minister of Israel for half of the 20 years since the assassination of Rabin.
Exactly. Right. And that gets to the idea of this gradual shift. And Rabin's Labor Party over that 20-year period has been in office for only about 19 or 20 months, a very short amount of time.
You also describe, and this is one of the rallies where Benjamin Netanyahu was speaking, and there were people, dressing up Rabin in apparently Nazi uniforms and doing some of these other very provocative things, even yelling death to Rabin from the crowd. Was Netanyahu aware of what was going on? Did he see it? Did he hear it?
I think it's very clear that he was aware. This was going on at rallies throughout the period leading up to the assassination, really for months. And the rhetoric got uglier and uglier. And it's clear that he's aware because there is at least one moment where he says, this is going too far, don't call him a murderer. But in the rally that you're describing, it was a few weeks before the assassination. Mm-hmm. Things really got out of hand, and Netanyahu is on the stage overlooking the crowd and doesn't do anything to pull it back, to rein it in. And it's a key moment. It's a key moment in terms of this right wing anger and inflammatory rhetoric, which, you know, to this day, I think people on the left in Israel, family members of Rabin, believe helped create this atmosphere that allowed Amir, or that encouraged Amir, to assassinate Rabin.
And can we say that Netanyahu, if not, what, let it happen? I'm trying to pick my words carefully here. Or didn't intervene or didn't understand?
Well, certainly when it comes to the rhetoric, I think he didn't intervene. I think if you asked him today and if he was being honest about it, most of the time, and I should be nuanced about this, as I say, there is at least one moment where from a stage he says, you know, Rabin is wrong. Don't call him a traitor, but Rabin is wrong about this. That's one example, but I've seen footage of many other rallies where he doesn't say anything at all, and I think in that way he was part of this this ugly rhetoric.
And we're almost up in a break here. Does that say something about Benjamin Netanyahu?
Benjamin Netanyahu was a young politician at the time, and he was trying to find his footing. He had just become a couple of years earlier head of the Likud party. He was being challenged from inside, from his own party. He was trying to figure out what is the cause that he can attach himself to? What are the groups that he can attach himself to? And at times those groups were not just on the right, but on the far right. So political expedience or ideology, I think it's probably a combination of both.
Well, let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. We've got some folks that want to join us. Dan Efron is our guest, and he has reported from Israel over the years, served as Jerusalem bureau chief for Newsweek and The Daily Beast. And again, he's got a new book, Killing a King, The Assassination of Yitzhak Rabin and the Remaking of Israel. Calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. I see a bunch of emails, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. I'm sure many of you can remember that historic photograph of Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin and PLO leader Yasser Arafat shaking hands, although not enthusiastically, on the White House lawn. This was back in 1993, also when the Oslo Accords are being signed. 2 years later, Rabin was murdered by a fundamentalist Israeli law student who was convinced that Jewish law demanded his death. That's what we're talking about with our guest, Dan Efron, author of a book called Killing a King. An email from Avi says, can you please say more about Rabin's last speech just before the assassination? Can you do that, Dan?
Yeah, Rabin was not a particularly good speechmaker. He didn't have the kind of charisma that, for instance, Bill Clinton did. And I mention that because Clinton was president when Rabin was prime minister. And the relationship between them begins somewhat cold, but grows to be very, very warm. But on this particular occasion, on the night of his death, I think he found his groove. In part, I think, because he was overwhelmed. He was thrilled that Israelis had come out in such large numbers for this rally, for this peace rally. And he talked about having been a soldier for much of his life and having engaged in war against the enemy and knowing that that was, the thing that Israel had to do over a large period of its history, but now coming to terms with this idea that there is an alternative and that it's worth pursuing.
Another email, this one from Fred. He says, the assassin represented only a very small element of the Israeli electorate, as evidenced by their small representation in the parliament when Arafat walked away from the peace agreements in 2000 and Clinton openly blamed Arafat. There was no evidence Rabin would have been more successful. And of course, I mean, we've done, as many people have done, sort of hours and hours of programs trying to understand why the peace process has gotten stalled and I guess who has been responsible for that. Do you think there's responsibility shared on both sides?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, and I think you started by saying that we don't know, and I think that's exactly right. I think one of the most agonizing parts of the assassination is that the idea that we can't know how far Rabin and Arafat would have gone. I would say this: it's pretty clear to me after working on this book for a couple of years, and in retrospect, in hindsight, 20 years later, that if there was a moment that Oslo could have succeeded, or more generally, that this two-state solution could have been come to fruition, it was probably then, in part because, you know, that process just had not been poisoned yet by years and years of violence and wars and settlement expansion and all the things that make the two sides lose faith in the possibility that they can live side by side.
How is Rabin viewed today in Israel?
Well, Rabin's legacy, I think, is bound up largely with the legacy of the Oslo process. And because there's not much left of that process, I mean, it still exists formally. It's still, the way that the West Bank is carved up is still, and the economic relationship between Israel and the Palestinians is still steeped in that old deal, that Oslo deal. But also, the spirit of Oslo has been dead for some time, I would say. And because of that, I believe that the legacy of Rabin is doesn't loom very large in Israel anymore.
And how about Yigal Amir? How is he viewed in Israel?
Getting back to that email, he's right. Only a kind of small margin, small group of Israelis on the margin supported the assassination at the time. Now, I think that that his support for him has moved a little bit from the margins and towards the right or towards the mainstream. It's still small numbers. There's a taboo still, I think, against the idea of praising the assassination or praising the assassin. But you do see in polls some number of Israelis, sometimes it's 15% or 20 or even a quarter of Israelis, who talk about the idea that it's time to release Yigal Amir from prison. And I think that's code for something like, maybe murder was wrong, but the idea behind it of getting Rabin out of the way in order to save Israel was right, something like that.
Is he serving, though, a life sentence?
He's serving a life sentence, but in the Israeli penal system, a life sentence is generally commuted to about 20 years.
Oh.
Yeah. And it requires the president to pardon him. It's hard to imagine a president pardoning him, certainly not in the current Israeli political context. So I think that he will probably spend the rest of his life behind bars.
And unrepentant? I mean, at this point?
Completely unrepentant.
Let me get actually an anonymous caller from Bryn Mawr to join our conversation. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I just wanted to make an overall comment. I grew up as a Muslim, and a large part of my family would gather around discussing. I remember growing up, hearing conversations between my uncles, my dad, and brothers and sisters and everything talking about the Israeli situation. And when Yitzhak Rabin came on, it was sort of this sort of hope and, expectation that maybe something will be solved and something of substance will happen in the Middle East between the Jews and Muslims or Israelis and Palestinians. And then his assassination happened, and I got to say, having lived through that and then experienced 9/11, that I think for many moderate Muslims, that Rabin's assassination was tantamount to a lot of the feelings that many people had for September 11th, because a lot of just possibility, hope, and all kinds of things just went and vanished into thin air on top of the fact that it was a Jew that killed him. So, and I think, I really appreciate the guest bringing up the point about Benjamin Netanyahu, because also I've heard a lot of things about, within my family, I have a lot of politically savvy people, and they talked about Netanyahu and his, not involvement, I don't want to say, but basically what you summarize. And I think a lot more discussion needs to happen in general, not just on your show, but in general about, the current state of Israel and how it's gotten to where it's gotten and what's going to happen in the future and how Netanyahu kind of got it where it is.
Well, I'm glad you called into Radio Times, and an interest coming from a Muslim also, and making this interesting parallel between the assassination of Rabin and, what happened in this country on September 11th.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I would say that, you know, the Oslo process had shortcomings from the get-go. It wasn't a slam dunk. It wasn't totally clear that it was going to work. But it did put in place these things that are very hard to imagine today. And one of them that, you know, during the research I went back to and kind of looked at, Israeli and Palestinian security officials were conducting joint patrols in the West Bank. They were getting into, you know, jeeps together and patrolling the West Bank and Gaza together and looking for threats that undermined both sides. Now, if you read the headlines today and you see what's going on and you know, the situation between Israelis and Palestinians, that's just unfathomable. It's hard to imagine that kind of thing. And it was the kind of thing that Oslo created and helped generate this sense of hope and the sense that something was different, that the two sides had pivoted and were in a different direction.
Let me see what Joe from Upper Darby has to say. Joe, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
My question, I remember these events, but one thing that I remember is the Oslo process was a product of tremendous pressure by American diplomacy, which I don't think we've ever seen since. And that in many ways, Yitzhak Rabin had to be dragged into taking the leadership of this. I think that the process actually began with the Yitzhak Shamir government, which was a Likud government, which had to be undermined, really, in order for labor to take power.
Well, Joe, I appreciate your call to Radio Times. You want to weigh in on that, Dan?
Yeah, actually, no. The Oslo process, the Americans are not involved, at least in getting the Oslo talks underway. These first set of talks between Israel and the PLO and Yasser Arafat's PLO, those talks are conducted secretly in Norway, in Oslo. That's hence the name. And the United States is unaware for the first several months and not involved. And it's really this moment about 6 months into the talks where the Israeli foreign minister comes to the United States and briefs the Clinton administration about it and hopes that the U.S. will be on board because the U.S. is also has the PLO listed on its list of groups that sponsor terrorism. Later, the U.S. does become, of course, very involved in the process. But I think the arm twisting is not with Rabin. Mm. You know, there I think there was a feeling of a common agenda. It wasn't until Netanyahu gets elected after Rabin's assassination where the United States really has to put a lot of pressure on Israel to comply with that deal, to continue carrying out the agreement as was detailed in the Oslo Accords.
And I believe you wrote that Arafat and Rabin had never met face-to-face before the White House ceremony. Do I have that right?
That's exactly right. And Rabin is reluctant. And in fact, Clinton in his memoir talks about the first interaction between them before they go out on stage where they're still in the Oval Office. And I think Arafat kind of makes a gesture to reach over to Rabin, and Rabin says, "We'll do that out on the stage." And that handshake is really the first thaw in this
wow.
This relationship over many years.
I mean, it wasn't the most fluid handshake. Can we say that?
You almost see Clinton pushing them together with his big arms. That's exactly right.
Let me get looks like Sarah from Haddonfield to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Sarah. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, hi, thank you.
Sure.
I was just wondering, does Israel enforce a death penalty? And if they do, why Amir would not have gotten the death penalty?
Sarah, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Do they have a death penalty, and why did they?
That's a good question. There is a death penalty on the books. It has been invoked, I think, only once or twice in Israel's history. Eichmann. The high-level Nazi official who is brought to Israel in the 60s and put on trial was put to death. I don't think any other mm-hmm. suspect has been put to death since.
Rabin's widow, and this is what, about a week after his assassination, merely makes a very moving speeches at somewhere. I mean, she speaks publicly about her husband and I guess what she hoped he would have been able to accomplish.
Yeah, and she talks about this idea. And, you know, a week after the assassination, Israelis returned to that city square in Tel Aviv in large numbers, even larger than the peace rally a week earlier. And she speaks very movingly, and she talks about this idea that initially she felt that the death of her husband meant the death of the peace process, but that she had been encouraged in that 7-day period by this outpouring of support and sympathy for Rabin, and that she now has come to view her husband as a martyr for peace, as a man who has given him his life for the possibility, the prospect that these two sides can come together.
Let me see what David from Center City, Philadelphia has to say. David, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Go ahead.
I just want to make a point. You said the conflict is about real estate. So I want to, just put a question in here and say, if real estate is the problem, then how come there wasn't peace from 48 to 67? Because Israel did not occupy any land up until 67.
Okay. No, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And I mean, I was being a little glib there and sort of boiling it down to some of its essentials. Obviously, Dan, much more complicated than that.
Oh, sure. And that's a good point. I mean, first of all, the conflict has shifted in different ways. There was, periods where the issue was the refusal to recognize the idea that Israel had a right to exist. But by the 90s, there is this turn. There is this pivot on behalf of by the PLO. And part of that Oslo deal, Israel and the PLO exchange letters where the PLO says, we recognize Israel's legitimate right to exist. Now, what the Palestinians hope to get in exchange for that legitimacy and that recognition is some part of the territory that they felt they lost in 1948. In other words, at least parts of the West Bank and Gaza, or all of the West Bank and Gaza, where they can have their own state, where they can build their own independence.
David, thanks for the call to Radio Times. A question I should have asked at the very beginning of our interview: why is your book called Killing a King?
I get that question because obviously Rabin was not a king.
Exactly.
He was an elected leader. He was the prime minister of Israel. The two brothers, Yigal and Haggai, write letters from prison. They write letters home and to family members, and they're trying to explain to these family members why they did what they did. We said they're both steeped in scripture. They both know the Torah very well. And the brother Haggai, who I would say might be the more articulate of the two or the more thoughtful of the two, he writes a letter where he puts this whole thing in the context of Jewish history, of the long arc of Jewish history, of prophets and kings and so on. And he writes in the letter, according to Judaism, killing a king is profoundly significant. It affects the entire nation and alters its destiny. They felt that this single act was going to change Israel's course. They certainly felt that at the time, and I think they feel vindicated today, 20 years later.
And I sort of asked this before, and we're almost out of time, but I mean, some truth to what he said there.
Oh, there's no doubt that this was a watershed moment, that this sets off this chain reaction that shifts power from the pragmatists like Rabin to the ideologues.
Well, on that note, Dan Efron, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. And again, the book called Killing a King, The Assassination of Yitzhak Rabin and the Remaking of Israel. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about the program, how to download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for the newsletter, listen to us on satellite radio. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.